Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This is our 200th episode. To celebrate the occasion, we've gone back in the vault for highlights from the 10 most listened to episodes of the past 100. So that's episodes 101 through 199. Enjoy these top 10 clips and listen to the full episodes wherever you get your podcasts. We have included the episode numbers so you can more easily find them. To start us off at number 10, author Ashley C. Ford discusses the process of writing her memoir, Somebody's Daughter, with Eve L. Ewing. Recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 130.
One of the things I realized when I was writing the book was that I was trying really hard not to write me. I was trying really hard to write about my experience of other people, kind of, but it was about them. I wanted it to be about what was going on around me, and I didn't actually want my voice to really be part of it. And that was not working for a myriad of reasons. One, it's a memoir. The first two words are literally, like, the first word in memoir is me.
Yeah, and then, like, it's moi.
You know, and then it's more. So it's like I had to write about me. But also what I was realizing is that it was because I was still not owning my story.
Right,
like,
right.
It took me so long to recognize that just because my perception and my view of what was going on when I was 10 or 11 wasn't respected doesn't mean that it wasn't mine, and it doesn't mean that it wasn't accurate from my perception. And it didn't mean that I couldn't hold on to it as I didn't need anybody else's permission. I didn't need anybody else's version of it. I could trust myself. And that's really the through line, I think, of the process of writing the book from beginning to end, was that if this book taught me anything, it was that I can trust myself. Mm-hmm. I'm allowed. So yeah, that's pretty much like how that process went. It was like, how much can I trust me? How much do I trust me? And how much am I willing to share?
Next up, Amani Perry discusses her National Book Award-winning work, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon Line, to understand the soul of a nation, with writer Dawn Turner. Recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 119.
But I love the way you ended that chapter, because you were saying, like, I hope you're not praying to the God. If you could pray to the God of the slaves,
yeah,
a more generous God.
Yes.
So talk a little bit
about that. Yeah, I draw this distinction in the book between the God of masters and the God of slaves.
Yes.
Is there two competing religious traditions, Christian religious traditions in this country? So her God, she described as someone who, you know, if you were saved, you would rule, like, sitting next to God, like kings and queens. And I thought, who are you ruling over?
Right.
What are you imagining? And then I thought, in contrast, the tradition out of which I come is one, you know, it's the Exodus tradition.
Yeah.
And so it's a let my people go. It's freedom. And so those, we had the same texts, the same religious texts in a very different interpretation. And her response to her experience of humiliation and degradation and being abandoned by her husband was to imagine being a ruler, right? And I was trying to suggest, oh, but you could imagine the way we do.
Right.
Not imagine being a ruler, right? Imagine being free. And so for me, the prayer was about, you know, when, at one point I talk about having more empathy for the so-called hillbillies than the one who wrote their elegy, mm-hmm. J.D. Vance. But it's real.
Yeah.
It's real,
right.
Because there are levels of oppression,
right,
and the exploitation. And he is someone, you know, who sees them as shameful.
Right.
And I... Even as I understand that those very communities hinge their sense of self-worth on being superior to us, I can also recognize the ways in which they suffer, right? I think the meth crisis is very similar to the lean crisis.
Absolutely.
Right? They're coming from the same place. There's
right.
There's so much common ground, and so I want to be honest about that.
Yeah.
Up next, former U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo speaks with Literary Director of the Library of Congress, Marie Arana, about craft, creativity, and seeing themselves in literature. Recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival, This is episode 113.
But the poetry thing really surprised me because it came out of one. I always loved reading and I always loved poetry, and I loved my local library, which was part of a strip mall, and hung out there. But it was knowing that it was becoming part of Native rights movements as a member of Kiva Club, the Native Student Club, and it was also meeting real Native poets and realizing, oh my, wow, you know, I loved Emily Dickinson, I loved all this poetry, but my image of a poet was an old white man in England, because that's what we were reading mostly at school at that time, which was fine. I loved the poems, because poetry can speak across culture boundaries. I mean, there's language can get in the way, but it you know, it has that power. But to meet Native poets, you know, I knew Leslie Marmon Silko, the novelist, first as a poet, her poetry, and then her short stories, and then her novels. Simon Ortiz, James Welch, and that's when I started writing. And it took over, and I still don't understand. I mean, we didn't grow up with poets in our neighborhood. We did not grow up hearing ourselves as part of poetry. Rather, it was something the teachers were afraid to teach. And then I came to learn how poetry is always there at transformational moments, and we were certainly in a transformational moment at that time in history, just like we are now. And poetry becomes a poem becomes a kind of transformer station to make a shift, to change, to make a place, where you can communicate without words, but absolutely with words.
Up next, poet and essayist Ross Gay discusses and reads from his essay collection, Inciting Joy, recorded live at the American Writers Museum in 2022. This is episode 117.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard conversations about W.H. Auden's famous line from his poem, In Memory of W.B. Yeats. Quote, poetry makes nothing happen. I have been to panels titled such, where people have hand-wringing conversations about the political utility of poetry. You know, can poetry be an agent of change? Can poetry interrupt the regime? Can poetry bring the masses into the streets to shut this thing down? Always invoked in these conversations is Neruda, whose poems, even the long ones, coal miners in Chile could recite. Or some Russian poets who filled stadiums because the people needed it. It was under the brutal repression of communism, etc. Seems to me those poets and attendees would have been sent to Siberia or the Gulag, but I guess that's not the point. The point everyone insists on, desperately, is wrong, W.H., poetry makes something happen. At some point, probably I heard someone else say it. There's a footnote that says, that's a link to an article that says it. It occurred to me that all these poets and all these conversations were misreading Auden's line, and that he was really talking about, in as much as a poem is him talking about something, what poetry makes. The sometimes product or effect or wake or artifact of poetry or a poem. Granted, the line feels emphatic, grand, provocative even. Seriously, I can't tell you how many tweed-jacketed reputations to Auden's line I have endured. No one has ever explained to me the elbow patch. But what the line makes made is not nothing, but nothing happening. Or rather, nothing happening. The happening it makes is nothing. In other words, a poem or poetry can stop time, or so-called time at least. First of all, what a good reminder it is that a poem is an action, and as Auden has it, a powerful one too. Secondly, and not for nothing, this is one of the suite of poems Auden wrote in the late 30s and early 40s, a period when one might have wanted so-called time, the clock, the airplanes, the trains, the perfectly diabolical, synchronous goose-step rhythm of time itself, to stop. Unless, of course, you were the regime, or IBM, or Bayer, or the arms manufacturers, or the munitions makers, or the other companies profiting from the slaughter. More sales, more slaughter, more sales, more slaughter, more sales. Footnote. As Arundhati Roy asks, rhetorically, in her book, Capitalism, A Ghost Story, quote, do we need weapons to fight wars? Or do we need wars to create a market for weapons? After all, the economies of Europe, the United States, and Israel depend hugely on their weapons industry. It's the one thing they haven't outsourced to China. End footnote. Unless you are among the prophets and profiteers of progress, which so often is another word for murder, albeit sometimes murder outsourced, you too might have been praying for a way to stop the march of so-called time. And poems sometimes might do that. Poems are made of lines, which are actually breaths, and so the poem's rhythms, its time, is at the scale and pace and tempo of the body, the tempo of our bodies lit with our dying. And poems are communicated ultimately body to body, voice to ear, heart to heart. Footnote, the heart's perhaps the most reliable clock we have. Even if those hearts are not next to one another in space or time, poetry makes them so. All of which is to say, a poem might bring time back to its bodily, its earthly proportions. Poetry might make nothing happen. Inside of which, anything can happen.
Up next, author and professor Leonard N. Moore discusses the shortfalls of performative justice and his book, Teaching Black History to White People, recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival. This is episode 126.
That's what we call performative justice. I mean, I don't know about you all, but I was getting emails every day from companies. Black Lives Matter from, what's the name of the big pet store and all these strip malls, what's it called?
Petco?
I don't even own a pet. And so that is what we call performative justice. And I'm losing my voice. Here we go. There was a situation, and this gets to performative justice. There was a situation at the University of Texas Law School. They got about 3 black professors. Okay, so I got a call from the dean one day. He said, Leonard, we have an issue. Some students had a problem with a question on the exam. Black professor teaching a constitutional law class had an exam question. It just said, defend school segregation from a legal perspective. Now, I was always taught that a good lawyer could argue both sides of an argument. Mm-hmm. This is an intellectual exercise. Oh, the students were up in arms. Mm-hmm. So when the dean asked me to come over there and talk to the students, I said, I bet you it's going to be a room full of white students. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. It was 10 white students, 1 black student, and 1 Latino. And the ringleader was a 30-year-old white student. Oh, Leonard, Dr. Moore, that professor should be fired? He should never be able to give an exam again? If the university keeps him, all of his exams should go through some approval process? They were that upset over a question. And I asked the law professor and the dean to leave. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, this really upset y'all, huh? They said, yes. I said, how many law students did this school bring in this past year? They said, 296. I said, how many were black? I said, 7. So I said, so this is my issue. You are more upset about a question on the exam. But if you would ask black students what they want, they want more black students in the school. And that is the kind of performative justice we gotta check. Mm-hmm. Even with taking down some of the statues. Understand, if you ask black students on these campuses, what is removing the statues rank in rank order, they probably say number 8. But what happens in my issue with white liberals is that they often assume that they know what's best for black people, mm-hmm. and they wanna speak for black people. Listen to this. I live in Austin, Texas. There's a community, it's gentrified now, but 10 years ago, it was East Austin, an older black community. And I said, told my students that we're gonna do something real radical. I said, let's sit in here and brainstorm about what you think the community needs. Better schools, recreational facilities, grocery store, all that stuff. I said, we're gonna do something radical. We're gonna go knock on the doors for 4 hours and we're gonna find out what they want. You know what they wanted? Number one was, they wanted speed bumps in the street. You know why? Because people flying through there trying to get to downtown, their kids were getting hit by cars. So the point is, you wouldn't know that unless you live there. And I tell white liberals all the time, the number one thing you can do is ask black folk, hey, what can I help you fight for?
Up next, Academy Award-winning screenwriter Aaron Sorkin discusses the process of adapting Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird for the stage. Recorded for the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 101.
I went back, I threw that first draft out, and
I started again, this time facing some hard truths about To Kill a Mockingbird, the novel. One of the more important ones was this. Atticus in the novel, and in the movie as well, doesn't change. He's the same person at the end of the story as he is at the beginning. And a protagonist has to change, and a protagonist has to have a flaw. I thought, why then was Harper Lee able to get away with having an Atticus who didn't change? Why was Horton Foote, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay, why was he able to get away with having an Atticus who's the same at the end as he is at the beginning? And the answer is, in the book and in the movie, Atticus isn't the protagonist, Scout is. She changes by losing some of her innocence. Her flaw is that she's young. Well, I wanted to keep the kids, Scout, her brother Jem, their friend Dill, I wanted to keep them as protagonists, but I wanted the central protagonist to be Atticus, which meant he was going to have a flaw and he was going to have to change. So what was that going to be? Was he going to go from being a good father to a bad father to a good father, a bad lawyer to a good lawyer, a racist to someone who believes in equality, justice, and inclusion? And it was no. And then I realized just reading the book again, and I have to tell you, just going back and revisiting a book that I hadn't read since eighth grade, I'd seen the movie a whole bunch of times, but hadn't read the book since eighth grade. There were a number of things in the book that I found troubling about Atticus. And primarily, it was that he is constantly excusing racism. Bob Yule, who is in the book and in the movie, he's just a horrible racist. In the play, I made him what he is, which is a Klan member. About Bob Yule, he says, well, you got to understand, he just lost his WPA job. That makes a man feel small. So, you know, let's walk in Bob Yule's shoes for a mile and see how we feel. The next door neighbor, Mrs. DeBose, is a terrible racist. Well, you got to understand, she just stopped taking her medication, and that changes a person. About the whole town, you got to understand, this is the Deep South. Things move slower here in the Deep South. Just give Makem time. And his belief that there's goodness that can be found in everyone, and to really know someone, you've got to crawl around in their skin. And it was right around that moment, sort of in my thinking of that Atticus already had a flaw. It's just that it was taught to us as a virtue, this idea that there's goodness in everyone and you have to crawl around in everyone's skin. It was right around that time that Donald Trump got up and said there were very fine people on both sides. And I thought, okay, here it is. Not for a moment do I think that Atticus and Donald Trump are the same person. There's plenty of daylight between the two of them. Just not enough daylight for my taste, for a hero.
Next up, author Kim Michelle Richardson discusses her novel, The Bookwoman's Daughter, and honoring her Kentucky roots. Recorded for the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 105.
First of all, it was always just a privilege to be able to share my Kentucky stories with the outside world, and also that I work with great editors and source books who have let me keep my voice and honor and respect my voice and my Kentucky people and its history. I try not to read reviews. Those are no for authors. I'm an old girl, and I've experienced more than most folks have a dozen lifetimes. I'm writing Kentucky, and Kentucky and its history and people are complicated, messy, brutal, and beautiful. So I don't listen to the outside noise telling me what Kentucky should ever be like or how I should write Kentucky. I have to write it as honestly and authentically as I know how. I did want to tell you, Allison, one of the very first reviews came in from a gentleman who was a librarian, and he's also a Blueskin people. And he received the ARC, and he just had such high praise, and he sent the letter to me and my editors. And so that meant everything, and that kind of meant I didn't need to be listening to anyone, you know, about my work and my writing. My writing's not going to be for everyone, but as long as I'd honored the Kentucky people. And then I, another librarian, a young blue-skinned librarian, she could hardly express herself. She was crying so hard. You know, the book had honored her and lifted her up. So, so you know what? I said I set out to do my job. I got to get rid of any outside noise.
Up next, a comedy writing panel that features comedians Cristela Alonso, Karen Chi, Peter Gwynn, Alexandra Petri, and Peter Sagal sharing insights into their craft. In this clip, Alonso discusses being honest in your comedy and trusting your voice. Recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 125.
Because, you know, I ended up getting a TV show based on my life. So for me, stand-up, what I learned was that everything that was funny to you was going to be funny. And that was the problem with a lot of people, that when we started, so many of us were trying to write what we thought people would laugh at. And there's a difference in that. Because when you're trying to create something that you think people are going to laugh at, they never will, because it's not coming from a really honest place. Anything, everything comes from the truth, for me. You know, and the truth can be hilarious, and science fiction can be based on truth, you know, and everything it is. So, like, how do you know it's funny? I've always said that if I think it's funny, if I would laugh at it, because in stand-up, you know, I'm writing everything, and then I go to a club, and I throw these ideas out, and then it becomes an episode of something, you know, and you just kind of go up there, and you're like, go with me on this. But I always learned that for you to trust what's funny, you really have to trust your voice and know that you got the idea for some reason. So you go with that, even though it generally doesn't maybe start like a good idea, or like maybe it sounds like a sad topic, you can make it hilarious because that you wanted to. You had that, you wanted to, and you know, that's what you do.
I think you're the only one here who has regularly worked as a stand-up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so sad.
And no, stand-ups to me are terrifying. I could never do that, because the idea of just getting up by yourself in front of people who probably are drunk and definitely hate you and want you to fail and making them laugh. But one of the things that I know you guys do, stand-ups, is you will come out with material and you'll try it out and you'll see what you see what they respond to. Oh, that's funny. Oh, well, you work on that. You'll sharpen that. Maybe tomorrow I'll do it differently and I'll put an emphasis here and maybe I'll get a better laugh. Do you ever, like, try something with an audience and they don't laugh and you're like, they're wrong?
Absolutely. Because then you realize, because you have to gauge what room it is. You know, there's a couple different rooms that have different audiences, and they're like demos. And you know that one demo might not get, if I'm playing a room, like in Hermosa Beach, which is an affluent neighborhood, if I talk about, you know, growing up a squatter in a diner, which I did, they're like, what is this? Mm-hmm. You know, it might be a little hard for them to understand. But if there's a room where you actually see that it's a makeshift, whatever area it is, if it's in a community that actually has that, like, maybe kind of like socioeconomic, like, reasoning in life, they connect with it differently. So you have to think, are they going to go with that? Do they understand that? Because again, it's like some people won't get it, and you just can't explain it to them. Being first generation anything is different than being second generation or being here for many generations. And if people don't understand it, it's okay that they don't understand it, because people will. And you know, I'd rather get the people that get it wholeheartedly than try to appease everybody, because when you get a laughter at 100% or 80%, it hits so much harder and it's so much more special than getting a whole room at 40%.
Up next, coming in at number 2, legal analyst and author Elie Mystal discusses his book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, with Professor Ivy Wilson. Recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 129.
Think about it this way. Who wanted the three-fifths compromise? Who wanted to count African-Americans, enslaved humans, as three-fifths of people? It was the South. The North wanted 0/5, right? They're enslaved. They don't have any rights. Why should they count for representation? The South, no, no, no. They wanted to count them as kind of people so they would have more representatives from Southern states in Congress. But they didn't want to count them as full people because that would be hypocritical. And so 3/5 became the compromise that the slavers wanted to secure their rights in Congress. I can't, like, it's hard to, when you really kind of break it down, it is just the cojones on these people, right? Just the hubris on these people to demand representation in government on the backs of people they were enslaving by counting those enslaved people as kind of quasi almost people-ish for the purposes of representation. That is the 3/5 compromise. There are so many compromises written into the Constitution explicitly for the preservation of slavery. I've talked about the Second Amendment. We can talk about the 3/5 compromise. I didn't bring it up in the book, but I wasn't thinking of it in these terms when I was writing it, but like, there's a fugitive slave clause in the Constitution. Like, people think of the Fugitive Slave Act as one of the incitements for the Civil War, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. That just enforced a clause that was literally already in this Constitution, that if property had to be returned to its owner, right? So like, concessions to our slaver racist past, and I haven't even gotten into the misogynist past, right? There are all these concessions to how this particular group of white, wealthy, landholding colonists wanted their country to be. They knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to erect a Western slave empire. And again, I can say a lot of negative stuff about them, but stupid is not one of them. They knew what they were doing.
And finally, our most listened to episode of the previous 100 episodes, scholars David W. Blight and Kedrick Roy discuss the writing and legacy of Frederick Douglass. Recorded live at the 2022 American Writers Festival, this is episode 111.
Read some of his editorials in the crises of the 1850s, and you will find yourself thinking about right now. Think of the problem of disinformation. We hear about it all the time, every day. Disinformation, conspiracy theories, of all kinds, whether it's internet or Fox News or other networks. Douglass talked about that all the time. He talked about the, before George Orwell, he talked about the way language was misconstrued and used by pro-slavery advocates to say that dark is light and light is dark, and you know, blue is green and green is blue. He was doing all that. The issue of voting rights? If you're worried about voting rights, go read some Douglass. He may have overdone it. He believed the right to vote was the most important right of all. He once called it the ring of fire around all other rights. In fact, Douglass even advocated for mandatory voting. He was very open about it. He thought the United States should have mandatory voting and you are fined if you don't vote. Australia does that. He was advocating that in the 1880s. He thought home rule for the District of Columbia should have happened in 1882. That it should have been a state already. Anyway, and if you think, last point about that. We live through now, it seems, constant crisis, doesn't it? Everything's a crisis now. It is. Everything's a tragedy now, or so it seems. In Douglass's life, and I'm not saying he has prescriptions for this, but how you endure crises and setbacks and denial. I mean, he got Jim Crowed more times than he could ever count. He had to start processing it through humor, you know, to survive. But how one endures denial, humiliation, defeat, and then keeps at the cause because he knows it's right. That's what his whole life is about. Now, he had his critics, and he still has his critics that, you know, maybe he got out of touch later in life. He probably did in some ways. Maybe he didn't get this issue right, like the Exodusters story or some others. Maybe he was too loyal to the Republican Party, probably was. The original Republican Party, not to be confused with today's. But if you read some Douglas, almost anything, you will find that he's talking about issues that have never gone away.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.